As you're turning to Genesis 42 to 43 tonight, I've had a bit of a love-hate relationship with puzzles. You might find it strange that if you know me that I like puzzles, but I do. I remember as a young boy, often I would get a puzzle for one of my birthday presents from an auntie or an uncle. And I sort of liked the challenge of the puzzle. But the more difficult the puzzle, the more frustrated I would become. Because I would tip the box out with all the pieces everywhere and would sort of love that feeling, that challenge at the beginning. How am I going to put all the pieces of the puzzle together? But as the puzzles got harder, as I said, the more frustrated I would become, because I would sit with a really difficult puzzle and I would maybe get a fair bit into it, and then I just get to a point where I'm just like, I have no idea where I'm going. I have no idea where the next bit's going to come from. And in a sense, I ground to a halt. And the frustrating thing for me was that either on the back of the puzzle or on some sheet inside the puzzle board, you had the perfect picture of what it was meant to look like. But sometimes in my frustration, I would be sitting there with all these pieces of the puzzle and only about a third of the puzzle put together. And I wonder how I was going to put it all together to make this perfect picture. And it made me think that perhaps our lives are a little bit like that. We're broken people. We're weak people. We're sinful people. We're a struggling people. And sometimes our life can feel like a broken puzzle. All the bits are disjointed and all over the place. And we wonder how our lives will ever be put back together again. But there's someone who knows what the puzzle should look like. God knows. God can see the perfect picture for our life in the here and now, but more than anything, for the life yet to come. He knows how all the bits of the puzzles of our lives fit together. As Ken testified to tonight, Romans chapter 8, verse 28, and we know that God works all things together for good for those who love him. But for many of us, the fulfillment of that promise may not be until eternity that's yet to come, where all the pieces of the puzzle start to make sense, because God will explain it to us then. And that's where we find ourselves with the life of Joseph in Genesis chapter 42. We've entitled this series Shattered Dreams, because in Genesis chapter 37, if you've been with us, we know that Joseph gets a dream from God that all your brothers are going to bow down to you. All these other people are going to bow down to you. And I'm going to make your name great, Joseph. But then just a week later, we find that Joseph was thrown into a pit by his brothers. Then his brothers sold him into slavery. He was then on a slave trade gang on his way down to Egypt. Then in Egypt, he rises to prominence in Potiphar's house. And then Potiphar's wife comes and brings a false accusation against him. And now he's in the prison. And then in the prison, he rises to prominence and he's put in charge of many parts of the prison. And then the cupbearer and the chief baker forget Joseph after he revealed his dreams to them. And then we find that one person remembered him. Pharaoh was greatly distressed one night last week. He found he wakes up in a sweat with this very vivid dream about these seven animals, these gaunt animals, and then these seven fat animals, and how one is going to destroy the other. And Joseph was able to interpret the dream. Why? Because the cupbearer remembered that there was someone who was able to reveal mysteries and dreams in prison. And so Joseph, on a day like any other day in the prison, was brought from the prison to the palace. And Pharaoh stood back in amazement and said, "Is there anyone like this man, Joseph, in whom the Spirit of the God dwells?" And so we find actually, Joseph, at the end of our time last week, that his life has reached a really good point, that God has, in a sense, exalted him to the highest place in his life so far. But what about his family? And so we have to, as they would have said in the American TV shows, meanwhile, back at the ranch, we meet Jacob and the family again tonight. But if you're taking notes, I want us to focus on this: El Shaddai, God who puts the pieces of the puzzle together. El Shaddai, God who puts the pieces of the puzzle together. I wonder if you're the sort of person that keeps lists for things when you go shopping, your to-do list in work, or perhaps the day before you go on holiday, You get out that piece of paper the morning of the day before you go on holiday, and you write all the things that you do. If only I was as productive the day before I go on holiday, every day, I would get a lot done. But I wonder, do you keep another list? Do you keep a list of the names of people who've hurt you and who've offended you, who've wronged you, who've sinned against you? Because now tonight, as Joseph is going to meet his family again, 20 years have passed since that young Joseph skipped down the land in Canaan as a 17-year-old boy with his multicolored dream coat and said goodbye to the father whom he loved. 20 years have passed. Has Joseph kept a blacklist of all of his brother's names, of Potiphar's wife, of the cupbearer and the chief baker and the prison warden and all these people? Has he got a blacklist and so he will no longer forgive anyone because he's confused with the pieces of the puzzle of his life? He won't. Why? Because he knows El Shaddai. It's a name for God that we find at the end of our time tonight. The name El Shaddai can be broken up into El Shaddai, El being God, Shaddai being Almighty. And the two major ideas are associated with his name are these: his omnipotence, that he is El, he is God, he is all powerful. And then Shaddai being Almighty, that his name is sufficient, that he will provide exactly what he thinks we will need. One writer describes the name El Shaddai like this: God Almighty, the ever-present God who protects and provides, presents himself as the one who makes a covenant with human beings. And it's amazing that the name El Shaddai is used most prominently in one particular book in the Bible, the book of Job. And it seems as if in the book of Job, no one suffers more than Job nearly in the whole of the Bible. And yet the name that keeps popping up in the book of Job is God El Shaddai, God who is Almighty and the one who protects and sustains. R.C. Sproul, talking about God being El Shaddai, said this: when God revealed himself by this name to the patriarchs in Genesis, he focused on his power, revealing himself as the God who makes and keeps his promises. It was his name that demanded faith in what was coming, but not yet. Listen to this part. This is so important. The God behind the promise would be sufficient for now, even if the fulfillment of the promises could not be seen. God makes promises, and God is mighty to perform them. God is strong enough to accomplish everything he has said he will do. He has the power to fulfill every promise he has made to his people. Because in the story of Joseph, you could have said, God, after you gave him this dream and this promise, it would seem as if there is no way that you could work this situation together for good. I mean, you couldn't write this story how it has gone from amazingly good to amazingly bad. But you see, God is God El Shaddai, the God who is all-powerful and sufficient. I read this quote, and it's an anonymous quote, but one person has said this: God often does not show us his omnipotence until he shows us our impotence. God often does not show us his omnipotence until he shows us our impotence. This anonymous quote went on to say, when you realize God is all you have, you realize God is all you needed in the first place. And I believe Joseph learned this lesson. He's now the prime minister. But for 20 years, God has been shaping Joseph and molding Joseph, just like gold is refined in the fiery furnace. So Joseph has been tested and tried in many difficult circumstances, and he's come forth as gold. And perhaps that's how you come to church tonight. And you can identify with the people gathered in Asia Minor, and Peter, as an older man, writes to them in 1 Peter chapter 1. He says this: in this you greatly rejoice, even though for a little while you suffer trials of many kinds. He went on to say how we'll be refined in the fire and come forth as gold. We found out last week that sometimes God does more in the prisons of our lives and in the storms of our lives than he can ever do with us in the palace and in the throne room. And so we meet God El Shaddai in the life of Joseph. So let's go to Genesis 42 and let's pick it up at verse 1. Firstly, El Shaddai in the hardships of life. Chapter 42, verse 1. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you keep looking at each other?" Some of you parents have experienced that with your children over the summer. Would you just get out and do something? Stop looking at each other. He continued, "I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others, because he was afraid that harm might come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. Hardships of life for Jacob and his family has gone from bad to worse. Not only had he lost his beloved son 20 years ago, but it seems as if the famine is so great in Canaan that not only will he die, but all of his sons will die. They need a miracle. They need something to happen. They need food from somewhere. And so Jacob tells his sons, "You've got to go down to Egypt to get the grain." And so this is real hardship in their life. They've got emotional pain from losing Joseph, particularly Jacob. The family has been ripped apart by jealousy and hatred. You can imagine that it's not a happy place to live in Jacob's house with all of the jealousy and hatred that has gone and would be going on. And so we find them in a real particular place of hardship. Perhaps your life feels like that tonight. You're in a real place of hardship. You're wondering where God is. You're wondering how he will put the pieces of the puzzle together. But it doesn't get any better in the story for this part. Secondly, El Shaddai in the hardships of family life. Verse 6. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked. "From the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he'd remembered his dreams about them and said to them, "You're spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected." See, over the last 20 years, the brothers haven't changed. They live in the same area. They're the same shepherds. They come from the same family. They speak in the same way. Perhaps even they look very similar. But Joseph has changed. He's been to the pit. He's been into the prison. He's now in the palace. He's now in a different culture. He's learned a new language. He is schooled in a whole different way. He would have spoken a different language as well. He probably looked completely different in his dress code. And so the brothers don't recognize him, but Joseph, in a sense, can act in two ways. He's also the son of Jacob, the beloved son, but he's also, in a sense, the prime minister of Egypt. And so Joseph is going to move between these two worlds, and yet the brothers are stuck in one and they cannot recognize Joseph. He accuses them of being spies. Why? Egypt has always been at its most vulnerable from the northeastern border. In fact, a huge canal ran down from the Mediterranean Sea to Lake Timash as a defensive line. There was also a network of fortresses that lined the eastern border. Egypt was a security conscious then, as most nations are today, so the charge of spying out the land was not a bad pretense for trapping the brothers. So he accuses them of being spies, and that would have been okay for the court around them because they were very spy conscious. But the brothers had hated Joseph. This was the next time that they had met since that moment where they sold him into slavery. They were jealous of him. They hated him. So Joseph is going to test the brothers. Have they changed over 20 years? Has God changed their hearts towards Joseph and towards their father Jacob? And so we find the family still in the midst of hardship. They're still in the midst of trying to work out how to work as a dysfunctional family. And you tonight, you come to church and you say, my family is dysfunctional. And not only is my family dysfunctional, but me as a person, I am dysfunctional. And I am in desperate need of grace from God. I'm desperate need for Jesus to empathize with me in my struggle, not only individually, but as a family. And he can. In fact, Jesus knew what it was like to be hated by his family. He came to the people of Israel, but they rejected him. In fact, Luke chapter 19, verse 14 says, his subjects hated him and said, we don't want this man to be our king. The Israelites were looking for a Messiah who would be made in their own image, someone who would come and rescue them from Roman occupation. And so when Jesus came and said he was going to do it differently, they rejected him. They hated him. They didn't even recognize him. They despised him. They mocked him. They beat him. And they nailed him to a cross out of hatred for him and for what he said. So Jesus knows what it's like to be hated by his brothers and sisters. He also knows what it's like to be in a family with difficulties. Listen to what Hebrews chapter 2 verse 17 says. For this reason, he had to be made like his brothers in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people, because he himself suffered when he was tempted, and he is able to help those who are being tempted. So if you're struggling with your family life tonight, Jesus knows what it's like. And in a sense, in heaven tonight, there's a man up there, a God man. And Hebrews goes on to tell us in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. But we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Let us then boldly approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we might receive and find grace and mercy. Why? To help us in our time of need. So tonight, individually, tonight in your family, come to Jesus. He knows what it's like to struggle with temptation and hatred and jealousy. But the story goes on in verse 10 with the brothers in this dysfunctional family. They reply to Joseph in verse 10, no, my Lord, they answered, your servants have come to buy food. We are sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies. Now, how that must have grinded with Joseph. Honest men. The last time I met you, you sold me into slavery, and then you probably went back and lied to my father about what happened to me. How on earth are you honest men? But Joseph holds his tongue. Verse 12, he replies in a different way. No, he said to them, you have come to see where our land is unprotected. But they replied, your servants were, this is the truth, were 12 brothers, the sons of one man, which is the truth, who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more. Lie. Or they don't know the truth. And all this time, Joseph, who had tried to forget the pain of the past, in fact, he named one of his sons Manasseh. The Lord has made me forget all the problems of my life before, but suddenly all the emotions are now welling up in Joseph. The sons and the brothers that threw him into slavery, left him for dead, are now before his eyes. Would he forgive? Would he forget? Or would he do to them what they had done to him? Verse 14, Joseph said to them, it is just as I told you, you are spies. And this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you're telling the truth. If you're not, then surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies. And he put them all in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die." This they proceeded to do. They said to one another, and this is interesting, it's as if the penny's starting to drop 20 years later. "Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we wouldn't listen. That's why this distress has come upon us." Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy, but you wouldn't listen? Now we must give an accounting for his blood." But they did not realize that Joseph could understand them, since he was using an interpreter. He turned away from them and began to weep, but then turned back and spoke to them again. He had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. The pain of the past is now coming to the surface in Joseph's life. The pain of the past is now coming to the surface in the lives of the brothers. It's as if God is now stirring their consciences. And Joseph is acting on two levels: a Hebrew son and an Egyptian prime minister. They think that they can talk away in their Hebrew tongue and no one else will understand them. But they don't realize this is Joseph, the one who they thought was either gone forever or dead. But note what happens in verse 24. Joseph begins to weep. And as I was thinking about that, it seems that before there's triumph in our life, there's often tears. It seems before there's triumph in our life, there's often tears. And the shortest verse in the Bible describes Jesus weeping over Lazarus' death, one who had become like a brother to him. And in John chapter 11, verse 35, it says this: "Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, 'See how he loved him.' But some of them said, 'Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?'" You see, in our lives, there's often tears before there's triumph. And in just a few moments, Jesus was able to raise Lazarus from the dead, but he wept over the dysfunctional nature of the human race. Jesus stood over Lazarus' grave and he perhaps was reflecting on Genesis chapter 3 when sin had entered the world and the image of God was marred from that moment on. And Jesus was thinking, this is never the way it was meant to be. In individual lives and families' life, but the amazing hope was that Jesus, the perfect brother, was able to stand over Lazarus' tomb and his dead situation and say, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, even though he may die, yet will he live." And so Jesus brought Lazarus back from the dead. And you know, in our families, in our dysfunctional families, that same Jesus can bring our families back from the dead. He can bring situations that seem lifeless and broken. And he says, "I've come to be the one that binds up the brokenhearted, to release prisoners from captivity, to give sight to those who are blind, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, that his kingdom has come on earth." So there's life and opportunity for us when we find Christ in our situations. And Joseph knows God. He knows him as El Shaddai, the God who protects and sustains. So verse 25, Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to put each man's silver back in his sack, and to give them provisions for their journey. After this was done for them, they loaded their grain on their donkeys and left. Can you believe that Joseph acted like this? Joseph, if he had kept his black book of all the wrongs that his family had done towards him, never mind the cupbearer, never mind Potiphar's wife, he kept his black book. "They did this against me, she did this against me, he did this to me, he sinned against me." Joseph should have thrown them all in prison, locked up the key, and arranged a date for their execution. But And not only that, Joseph gives them abundant amounts of grain. He then gives them their money back. Why? Because he was showing them extravagant grace. He was showing them extravagant grace. Why? Because Joseph in the pit and in the prison and now in the palace knew El Shaddai, the God who protects and the God who sustains. Joseph had realized that knowing God was more important than anything else or what anything had been done to him in his life. But isn't that what we have received from Christ tonight? There's a lovely passage in 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9, talking about the extravagant grace of Christ. He said, 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich." And then a passage that is perhaps the pinnacle passage on God's grace towards us. Ephesians 2, verse 4, "But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ. And even when we were dead in our transgressions," and the brothers were dead, they should have died, they should have been executed, and we as sinners and transgressors should have been in the same situation. "But when we were dead in our transgressions, it is by grace you have been saved." Joseph's brothers, unite tonight. And not only that, here comes the superabounding grace. God just doesn't stop there. "And God raised us up with Christ and seated us with him in heavenly realms in Christ Jesus, in order that in the coming ages he might show the incomparable riches of his grace." It's amazing, isn't it? While we were dead and had nothing to offer him, we were rebels against him, he showed us grace. And so Joseph showed grace to his brothers. The amazing thing is that Joseph didn't keep a black book. In fact, he showed them grace. But think about this as well. Not only has God removed our name from being debtors to him, he's moved our name from being transgressors, and he's actually erased that, and he's put our names in the Lamb's Book of Life. That's how amazing his grace is. And he then becomes our Heavenly Father, and we become adopted children into the family of God with all of our brokenness, with all of our sin, with all of our dysfunctional natures, become sons and daughters of the King. So what happened with the brothers now that they've received extravagant grace? Verse 27, "At this place where they stopped for one night, one of them opened his sack to get feed for his donkey. And he saw his silver sack in the mouth of his sack. 'My silver has been returned,' he said to his brothers. 'Here it is in my sack.' Their hearts sank and turned to each other, trembling, and said, 'What is this God has done to us?' And when they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them. They said, 'The man who is lord over the land spoke harshly to us and treated us as though we were spying on the land. But we said to him, "We are honest men. We're not spies. We were 12 brothers, sons of one father. One is no more. And the youngest is now with our father in Canaan.' And then the man who is lord over the land said to us, 'This is how I will know whether you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me and take food for your starving households and go. But bring your youngest brother back to me so that I will know that you're not spies but honest men. Then I will give your brother back to you and you can trade in the land.' And as they were emptying their sacks, there in each man's sack was his pouch of silver. And when they and their father saw the money pouches, they were frightened. Their father Jacob said to them, 'You've deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more. And now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me.'" You ever felt like that? It seems as if life is falling apart, as if God is taking everything I've got from me. So Jacob felt. Then Reuben said to his father, "You may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Entrust him to my care, and I will bring him back." But Jacob said, "My son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead and he's the only one left. If harm comes to him on the journey you're taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow. Because thirdly, we meet El Shaddai in the sacrifice of a son." Jacob had to sacrifice a son in order for this situation to be resolved. But he does it so unwillingly that he would let another son go. Why? Because he's been grieving for 20 years over Joseph. He's afraid that it will happen to him again, but he doesn't realize that behind the scenes, God is putting all the pieces of the puzzle together again. But then fourthly, we see El Shaddai and the restitution of a family. Chapter 43. Now the famine was still severe in the land. So when they had eaten all the grain they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, "Go back and buy us a little bit more food." But Judah said to him, "The man warned us solemnly, 'You will not see my face again unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother along with us, we will go down and buy food for you. But if you will not send him, we will not go down.' Because the man said to us, 'You will not see my face again unless your brother is with you.' Israel asked, 'Why did you bring this trouble on me? By telling the man you had another brother?' They replied, 'The man questioned us closely about ourselves and our family. 'Is your father still living?' he asked us. 'Do you have another brother?' We simply answered the questions. How were we to know he would say, 'Bring your brother down here?' Then Judah said to Israel, his father, 'Send the boy along with me and we will go down at once so that we, you and our children may live and not die. I myself will guarantee his safety and you can hold me personally responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, I will bear the blame before you all my life. As it is, if we had not delayed, we could have not returned twice.'" And then down to verse 16. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of the house, "Take these men to my house, slaughter an animal and prepare a dinner. They are to eat with me at noon." The man did as Joseph told him and took the men to Joseph's house. And now the men were frightened when they were taken to his house. They thought, "We were brought here because of the silver that was put into our sacks the first time. He wants to attack us and overpower us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys." So they went up to Joseph's steward and spoke to him at the entrance of the house. "Please, sir," they said, "we come down here the first time to buy food. But at the place where we stopped for the night, we opened our sacks and each of us found his silver, the exact weight in the mouth of his sack. So we've brought it back with us. We also brought additional silver with us to buy food. We don't know who put our silver in our sacks." "It's all right," he said, "don't be afraid. Your God, the God of your father, has given you treasure in your sacks. I received your silver." Then he brought Simeon out to them. The steward took the men into Joseph's house, gave them water to wash their feet, and provided fodder for their donkeys. They prepared their gifts for Joseph's arrival at noon, because that they had heard that they were there to eat. The fifth thing here is El Shaddai in the bringing of shalom. Look what he says in verse 23. "It's all right," he said. "Don't be afraid. Your God, the God of your father, has given you treasure." The word "don't be afraid" is the translation of the Hebrew word shalom. In the midst of the storm that was raging in the hearts of the brothers, they get a word from God. Shalom has come. God is here. He's going to bring peace. He's God El Shaddai, the one who guides and protects and sustains in the most difficult of times. Don't be afraid. Just like when Jesus was with the disciples and they were out in the lake and there was a furious storm all around them and he was up on the mountainside and he was praying for them for hours and there he is walking out to them on the lake. They think it's a ghost, a phantasma. And there in their moment of greatest need when the storm of life was all around them, Jesus said, "Shalom to you. Don't be afraid. It is I." What difference does it make when Christ speaks into our situation? Because it's often when we get to the point of impotence that Christ's omnipotence begins to speak. And now they find peace together around the table. Joseph is now with his brothers. They are now sitting down for a meal. And they're being generously, in a sense, adopted by Joseph in their new land, even though they don't know it. And so I close with this tonight. in the painful puzzle of your life, can you trust God's heart when you can't see his hand? Can you trust his heart when you can't see his hand? Because Solomon, as he reflected at the end of his life and he looked back on all the pieces of the puzzle and not being able to fully work it out, he was able to say, God makes everything beautiful in his time.